Chip Hasenflug.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we are here at the end of the treasure hunt. We have the treasure. We have the suspect. We are ready for Chapter 11 of The Sign of Four.
The Great Agra Treasure. So this one opens right after we have captured Jonathan Small like an evil fish in a net. And it's kind of an interesting representation of Jonathan Small, isn't it? Our captive sat in the cabin opposite to the iron box, which he had done so much and waited so long to gain. He was a sunburned, reckless-eyed fellow with a network of lines and wrinkles all over his mahogany features, which told of a hard open-air life. And it goes on to describe him a little bit. Then Watson tells us his face in repose was not an unpleasing one. He sat now with his handcuffed hands upon his lap and his head sunk upon his breast while he looked with his keen twinkling eyes at the box which had been the cause of his ill doings. It seemed to me that there was more sorrow than anger in his rigid and contained countenance. Once he looked at me with a gleam of something like humor in his eyes. "Well, Jonathan Small," said Holmes, lighting a cigar, "I am sorry that it has come to this." "And so am I, sir," he answered frankly. It feels like there's sort of like, I don't know, some sort of respect among enemies between Jonathan Small and Sherlock. Did you guys get that feeling? Like there's a respect there.
Well, yes. Kind of a relief, too.
Jonathan Small is kind of a victim in all of this. He is a part of this plot. He is certainly the bad guy, but he's got hard times behind him. And this has been a tough life for Jonathan Small.
Has he even benefited really from this? I mean, it seems like...
And I feel like Watson describes Small using some of the same terms he often uses for Holmes, right? The twinkle in his eye, little bit of humor here and there. You know, he kind of, even though he looks exactly the opposite of Sherlock Holmes, there are some doubled features between those two, and they seem to almost like each other.
Well, they shared a cigar and, you know, you need a little snort of something.
And a flask. Don't forget the flask.
That's what I mean by that.
That flask is just passed around, man.
Well, later on, yeah, the police officer gets to have a little
something.
Because, you know, that's what it's like, you know, sharing among friends.
Jonathan Small is sad that Brother Bartholomew died, but he did not do it. He says, "I give you my word on the book that I never raised a hand against Mr. Sholto. It was that little hellhound Tonga who shot one of his cursed darts into him. I had no part in it, sir. I was as grieved as if it had been my own blood relation." Come on, Doyle. Really, the native's name is Tonga? Really?
The first thing I'm looking at this is like, no person would ever take the fifth here. You know, they're like, well, let me just tell you what happened.
Yeah, there is that. He's not trying to defend himself, but at the same time, he is trying to defend himself. He's saying, I did not kill that man. This other person did this.
Well, and it's interesting because Sherlock kind of, again, seems to have that little bit of a connection with Jonathan Small. And I wonder if it's because he tried to put himself into Jonathan Small's perspective in the previous chapter in order to try and figure out how he got rid of the boat. He feels like he's, you know, really sharing his worldview a little bit. Mm-hmm. Sherlock reminds the audience that he made a deal with Athelney Jones, so he gets the interview with Jonathan Small before the police do. This is not that interview, though, because he also made a deal that they check out the treasure first. So he says, "You are under the charge of Mr. Athelney Jones of Scotland Yard. He is going to bring you up to my rooms, and I shall ask you for a true account of the matter. You must make a clean breast of it, for if you do, I hope that I may be of use to you. I think I can prove that the poison acts so quickly that the man was dead before ever you reached the room."
Mm-hmm. Sherlock really seems to want to help this man. He seems to understand, maybe from that perspective from last chapter, that this man was a victim in all this, not a murderer.
Holmes is a method actor, and we he has to like really get into the character.
Yeah. But wait a minute. We've been reading this book. This has been a great romance story from beginning to this point. This has been a great action-adventure story. And we've got a final chapter tomorrow coming up that is it just going to be a lengthy info dump? Because I don't know that I'm ready for that.
It's a long chapter.
So get started early, folks.
Will they mention the sign of four in it at least?
And the chapter is titled The Strange Story of Jonathan Small. So, Steve, it's going to be your very favorite kind of chapter. I think we can see it coming.
Is it going to be like the second half of A Study in Scarlet, where we intimately understand this character and we don't know for sure if Sherlock understands the same things that we understand? Or is it going to be just storytelling from Jonathan Small sitting in the rooms?
It's going to be like a Pixar film where they're all connected some way, Steve.
It's going to be a silent film where we just see pictures. I dread the final chapter.
I don't think it's going to be a silent film. But other than that, I think you might be onto something.
All right.
The treasure has brought Jonathan Small nothing but pain. He says, but it does seem a queer thing, with a bitter smile, that I, who have a fair claim to nigh upon half a million of money, should spend the first half of my life building a breakwater in the Andamans, and am like to spend the other half digging drains at Dartmoor. It was an evil day for me when I first clapped eyes upon the merchant Archmet and had to do with the Agra treasure, which never brought anything but a curse yet upon the man who owned it. To him, it brought murder. To Major Sholto, it brought fear and guilt. And to me, it has meant slavery for life.
Well, isn't this possible? I mean, this is, in some way, unearned wealth, stolen wealth. And what did he do? The stolen wealth has brought nothing but pain to everybody who's been part of this. And for this guy, I mean, he's lived a life of misery. Imagine being wealthy and miserable because it may not have been earned.
And guys, this kind of comes out of almost the fairy tale or folklore tradition. This idea that we all want wealth. Like, we have this notion that wealth would really bring us happiness. But in fact, certain types of wealth, and just as Chip was saying, certain types of unearned wealth, in fact, are a curse and not a blessing. And, you know, there's research on this. I'm sure, Chip, you're much more familiar with it than I am. But, you know, the people who win the lottery, depending on the size of the winnings, end up, you know, scoring on the happiness quotient somewhere like people who've recently been diagnosed with terminal cancer. I mean,
maybe they go on QVC and buy all the Ninja Knives. You never know.
Right. And so, but this notion that large and unexpected boons of wealth can actually have hugely detrimental effects to people. That's a common thought. And that's what Jonathan Small is saying here. He's saying everyone who's touched this treasure has not benefited from it.
Including the Smith family. Jonathan does not want the Smiths to be in trouble here.
He proves himself to be something of a man of honor, right? So he says, listen, Mordecai Smith and his son, I just hired them because they had a fast boat. They don't know anything about what I was doing. And then Athelney Jones speaks up. Well, if he has done no wrong, we shall see that no wrong comes to him. If we are pretty quick in catching our men, we are not so quick in condemning them. It was amusing to notice how the consequential Jones was already beginning to give himself airs on the strength of the capture. From the slight smile which played over Sherlock Holmes's face, I could see that the speech had not been lost upon him. So all of a sudden, Athelney Jones, who negotiated away, looking at the treasure, interviewing Jonathan Small, having the dinner party. I mean, he is all of a sudden, this was his idea from the start. They're fasting their man.
He got a swig of whiskey out of this. Come on.
Watson does get the box and takes the treasure to Mary. Doyle gives us some more great description of Mary here. This is beautiful romance talk here.
Is this the part where we tell all of our listeners to go ahead and grab a box of tissues? This could get really, really touching.
This is not sad in any way. This is definitely romance.
Are you talking about this is a love story and these are tears of joy, Steve?
It's a poignant moment. And we're seeing Mary through the eyes of her finest suitor, our friend and Sherlock's, John Watson. She was seated by the open window, dressed in some sort of white diaphanous material with a little touch of scarlet at the neck and waist. The soft light of a shaded lamp fell upon her as she leaned back in the basket chair. And for some reason, that detail, she's sitting in this basket chair. It just, it seems like so at odds with this lovely gown, you know? Anyway, the lamp, the shaded light played over her sweet grave face and tinting with a dull metallic sparkle, the rich coils of her luxuriant hair. One white arm and hand drooped over the side of the chair, and her whole pose and figure spoke of an absorbing melancholy. At the sound of my footfall, she sprang to her feet, however, and a bright flush of surprise and of pleasure colored her pale cheeks.
It is.
So beautiful. So beautiful.
She was just waiting in her basket chair. I'm picturing like a big papasan chair.
Just imagine how elegant you can kind of flop out of that thing.
But when she hears the magic footfall, she leaps to her feet.
The patter of John Watson.
Watson is absolutely enamored here. He is in love with this woman, and he sees everything about her. And Doyle is so good at describing this. Her luxuriant hair is something that is a great detail that Watson is noticing this girl on a different level from anything else that we've described.
Following up from a couple chapters earlier when Watson went to visit Mrs. Cecil Forrester and Mary, and they were saying, oh my goodness, it's like a romance. And Mary said, ooh, with two knight errants. He asks Watson, tell me the whole story. Pray sit down and tell me all about it, Dr. Watson. I narrated briefly what had occurred since I had seen her last. Holmes's new method of search, the discovery of the Aurora, the appearance of Athelney Jones, our expedition in the evening, and the wild chase down the Thames. He listened with parted lips and shining eyes to my recital of our adventures. When I spoke of the dart which had so narrowly missed us, she turned so white that I feared she was about to faint. And this really, I love this because Mary's just like hanging on to his every word, right? But then just as Watson had that sort of, he almost passed out when he realized how very close he had come to death. I mean, these are two people in love, right? They both have that reaction of like, we almost lost not just John Watson, but like our opportunity for this new relationship. So it's a bit of a doubling of the earlier scene, I think.
Life is short. You got to go for it. Go for it, John.
Carpe diem. Absolutely.
This is such a good romance story that Doyle is writing here. Even though he said, don't write a romance story, make this about the mystery. The mystery is pretty crummy at this point, but the romance is pretty amazing.
And doesn't it become more apparent as the story, I mean, as we start getting towards the end?
What? The romance?
Of course, Steve. Isn't that really the treasure?
Yeah.
Aww. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Sweet chip. What were you going to argue, Pam?
So, Stephen, since you have not heard the strange story of Jonathan Small, I don't think you're really in a position to say that the romance is better than the mystery.
Yeah, I can. I'm anticipating the info dump of the final chapter. Maybe it'll be an action. Maybe it'll be another action. Maybe there'll be another boat chase. But I really doubt it from Doyle.
Yeah, it seems possible. Now, so you guys, any surprises in this chapter when we see that beautiful, super heavy, Mary can hardly lift it box?
Yeah, Watson says the treasure should bring Mary about 10,000 pounds, which is the buying power of about $1.5 million today. So this is exciting. We're finally going to see the treasure. So they open the box. What's in the box?
And then I love the description, right? So he gets the poker. There was in the front a thick and broad hasp wrought in the image of a sitting Buddha. Under this, I thrust the end of the poker and twisted it outward as a lever. The hasp sprang open with a loud snap. With trembling fingers, I flung back the lid. We both stood gazing in astonishment. The box was empty! Oh. Exclamation point. Dun, dun, dun.
Isn't wealth empty if you don't have someone to share it with?
Aww.
Oh my goodness.
That's two sweet things Chip has said. Pam, you're just the negative one.
Today.
A great shadow seemed to pass from my soul. I did not know how this Agra treasure had weighed me down until now that it was finally removed. It was selfish, no doubt, disloyal, wrong, but I could realize nothing save that the golden barrier was gone from between us. Thank God, I ejaculated from my very heart. He finally understands that the money was really an impediment to the real story, the real romance here.
John offered to get in the box and just stand there. He could be the treasure.
So then, moving on, with a quick questioning smile. Why do you say that, she asked. Because you are within my reach again, I said, taking her hand. He did not withdraw it. This is a very Victorian moment, right? So, and remember, he has held her hand before in a situation
of great peril. Was she wearing gloves at the time, or was it skin to skin?
She is very well gloved.
He was well gloved, but I believe that today, sitting on her papasan chair, her hand might be.
This is maybe too much. This is almost pornography.
Because I love you, Mary.
This is a commercial for Pier One.
Because I love you, Mary.
And John goes even further than that. Because I love you, Mary, as truly as ever a man loved a woman. Because this treasure, these riches, sealed my lips. Now that they are gone, I can tell you how I love you. This is why I said thank God. Then I say thank God too, she whispered, as I drew her to my side. Whoever had lost a treasure, I knew that night I had gained.
Oh my God.
I know, the tissues. Oh the tissues, everybody.
Anyway, that was
this is good romance. This is good. Is it good? Conversation.
You should try that tonight on your wife, see how that works.
Oh, we've already lost our treasure. Don't worry.
No.
We're good.
You need to use these words, Steve. Oh. And if you do it, just you can read them like William Shatner or Adam West, whichever you choose. They'll both work well.
They're finally happy. They've had this problem. This is a very Victorian problem that Watson had, right? She was going to be in the wrong class of people, and Doyle is very concerned about class, and now that the money is gone, now they are clear to be in love with each other.
Well, I was going to say, that's very British versus the American side, where money and class are not, you know, it's just different. Even when you have money, you may not, yeah, fit in, let's just say.
Mm-hmm. True. So the moral of the story, more money, more problems.
You should probably, I think that's what we'll do this. In fact, if we wrap this up, more money, more problems is the way that we should describe it.
That's all Doyle had to say. This whole chapter, this whole story, really, the story of this treasure is more money, more problems.
Isn't this story really about finding what really matters in life?
See, Chip is being sweet today. Jeez, Pam, stop being so negative.
Brother Bartholomew.
Right? I'm sorry, who?
Brother Bartholomew.
Poor Brother Bartholomew. I can't believe that he's gone, and we don't have any money to show for it.
Well, she's got all the, what is it, the pearls. Where did the pearls come from?
That was that one piece. They had that one piece of treasure, and they're going to apparently have to split that.
There's something else. If we write this story today, we could immediately say, okay, this is empty. So where was the real treasure? You know, it's got to be somewhere else.
And again, that's not what Doyle does. Doyle is setting up all of the tropes for mysteries, and there is no massive twist at the end. I don't expect a massive twist in the final chapter of this. I don't expect anything to come of this other than what he's already laid out for us.
I think that's fair, because we're so used to the challenge to the tropes in 21st century writing, but this is 19th century writing, setting up the tropes that aren't quite ready to be twisted yet.
All right. So we have one more chapter. We're going to get to that tomorrow. And then we have our wrap-up episode for The Sign of Four coming on Saturday, July 4th. So we have to pose a question to our listeners so we can have a little bit of fun discussion about this on Saturday. So our big question for this book is, what would you do with $1 million inheritance today in 2020? There's a list of things that we could suggest maybe you could do with your money. Vacation property, donating it to your favorite charity, splitting it with your loved ones, supporting your favorite podcast. There's all sorts of possibilities.
See, so what you're saying is on July 4th, we're going to be talking about financial independence.
Oh,
whoa!
I'm so proud of you, Chip. You are so positive today. Wow.
Well, yeah. Sherlock let me have a little sip of his magic elixir.
This is fun. This is exciting and a great romance and a fun action adventure story. But it all comes down to mo money, mo problems. What would you do with $1 million? That's our big question. We would love to hear from you. Give us a voicemail. We would love to hear the sound of your voice. Send us an email. Get us a text. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that feedback from around the world. And join us on Saturday. Well, join us tomorrow for the chapter that I'm dreading, where all of the information to support all of the fun that we had in the first 11 chapters. And then on Saturday for the wrap-up of The Sign of Four.
Then we can talk about Brother Bartholomew some more.
I hope there's so much Brother Bartholomew in chapter 12. I hope that is the highlight. That's the centerpiece of this story. But I don't think it's going to be.
It's hard to say, Steve. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out tomorrow. That's the fun of this, right? We are sticking to one chapter a day. We'll get to chapter 12 tomorrow, and we'll find out. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
Brother Bartholomew!
What I wanna talk about is what I wanna thank you for.